The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hi, this is Justin Coletti of Sonic Scoop. Thanks for joining me for another episode of the Sonic Scoop podcast. And today, I'm bringing you another MixCon Q&A from this year. Another hour-long conversation with one of the best mixers working out there today. And this time, it is Ronald Prent. He is an accomplished and innovative mixer with over 40 years of experience. He's worked in rock, pop, metal, classical, and he's been a pioneer in multi-channel formats and surround sound when it comes to mixing. He has a super long list of clients that includes The Police, Rammstein, Scorpions, Celine Dion, Simple Minds, Freddie Mercury, Queensryche, Tina Turner, Def Leppard, Depeche Mode, Manowar, and so many more. From pop to metal and everywhere in between, Ronald is doing some absolutely killer work, and I think he has some great insights into the process and into what really matters in mixing and how to go about it. I think you're going to get a lot out of this week's interview. This once again comes from a live stream interview, so it doesn't have as high audio quality as some of our usual podcast episodes, but it is definitely good enough to get some great insights out of Ronald Prent. But I'll tell you what, I'm looking to up the quality on our live stream audio even further because we're going to be switching this podcast in 2023 to a live streaming format. This is going to make it so I can get more interaction with you guys in real time, take your questions in real time, and also cut down on the length of time it takes me to produce each of these podcast episodes so I can free up some more bandwidth to make some more deep videos with you where we get to look, listen, and learn together, cracking open the DAW so I can put out more short videos for you guys and do more courses for you guys. Speaking of courses, all of these MixCon episodes are free to the public, and this one is free to the public thanks to our sponsors, which include you. And the best way to sponsor this podcast or any of our podcast episodes is to sponsor yourself. Check out one of our great full-length courses like Mixing Breakthroughs, where I'll give you a complete system to mixing. Mastering Demystified, where you can learn everything that I know about mastering, or Compression Breakthroughs, where you can finally learn to understand, hear, and use compression like a pro. All of them come with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Shout out and thanks also to Soundtoy, sponsoring this podcast from the beginning, making some of my favorite creative mixing effects in the known universe. Try out anything they make for free for 30 days over at soundtoys.com. And also this week, PSP Audioware, also a killer maker of great plugins. They've been one of the best sounding brands and plugins for more than 20 years. Ronald Prent is a big fan of theirs, and he's developing a plugin with PSP that we talk about in this live Q&A. Check him out over at PSPAudioware.com. Without any further ado, let's get right into it. Here's the MixCon Q&A interview with Ronald Prent. Hey, this is Justin Coletti of Sonic Scoop. Hope you can hear me. Hope you can see me. Type into the chat box down below. Let me know if the audio is coming through nicely for you. We just finished up with a masterclass from the great Ronald Prent, a Grammy-winning mix engineer with about 40 years of experience. He's joining us today from his studio in Auburn, New York, not too far from Rochester. Ronald, how are you doing today?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for being here and thanks for being a part of MixCon. Special thanks also to the artist Jeremy Oliver for allowing us to dive under the hood of this track. There were a lot of compliments about his track that came in during the premiere of the masterclass. People really seem to enjoy it. It is a catchy tune. I think it's going to be stuck in my head on my whole drive down to New York City later today. So I was glad to hear it. Another big thanks to PSP. PSP have been making some of the best plugins out there for, man, it's got to be a couple decades now. They made some of the, they made some of the first great sounding must have plugins, and they've been coming out with new stuff. It feels like year after year ever since. And Ronald has been secretly working on a new compressor with them for surround applications called Avocado. We got a sneak peek of that in here. If you want to try out any of the PSP stuff, please do go over to PSPAudioware.com. That's PSPAudioware.com. Type PSP plugins into the Googles and you'll get there. If you haven't tried their stuff, you've got to. I feel like the vintage warmer that they made 20 years ago, people are still using it today all over their tracks. There's so many cool plugins. You've got to check out the Infinistrip, really super interesting. Of course, Ronald uses the Oral Control for his surround stuff. I saw you use a lot of the inflator compressor on this one, as well as their spring and plate reverb. So I think Anthony from PSP is actually there in the live chat checking out the live Q&A with us. So Anthony, if you have any questions, type them in. One of the questions we got about PSP during the presentation was, is it true that PSP stands for Polish Super Plugins? Let us know what the PSP stands for. I've never actually asked.
Me neither. So,
curious to find out. Anthony, if you're in there, let us know in the chat box. Now, I do want to get through your questions. We're going to ask the best questions that you guys asked during the live premiere. I'm going to start with those questions that came in during the premiere of the masterclass, and then we'll get into new questions that are in the chat box. But I wanted to start off with just my first things that I noticed about your mixing masterclass. Oh, and for those of you who are joining us without seeing the mixing masterclass, Ronald has worked with everyone from Rammstein and Manowar, like metal bands like Def Leppard, to pop artists like Tina Turner and Elton John and Celine Dion, Depeche Mode. He's worked with Freddie Mercury of Queen and a whole bunch more, doing mixing for studio albums, live albums, and he's really been a pioneer in surround sound. So you can ask him questions on any of those topics. And if you haven't seen the masterclass yet, please do. One thing that I noticed, I really loved about your presentation, Ronald, is that you didn't just walk us through a mix you already completed. It's almost like you mixed it from scratch right in front of us, which I thought was really refreshing, very different than what is the norm in MixCon, and something that was the people in the comments really seemed to enjoy. And one cool thing I wanted to ask you is that at first, a lot of people were asking there, it's like he's not touching any processors first. He's just using his faders, and they really heard the mix just start to come together off of just you doing fader moves. So my first question for you is that the way that you often start a mix, using nothing but the faders? And if so, how far along does the mix get before you start applying more processing? And is there a certain point you're trying to get it to before you start adding processing? When do you start going from fader mode to all of a sudden compression and EQ and reverb and thinking more about those things?
Well, it comes from doing this for 40 years. It's a lot of experience, but when we got trained as an early junior assistant, and you learn to start learning mixing, the assignments were, now make this track work balancing without using anything. That's how I was started learning to mix. And then I did a lot of, I still do broadcast, and you don't have time in broadcast. You get maybe a minute, 2 minutes, then your mix has to kind of work. If you do the Count Basie Big Band on a jazz festival in The Hague, and you go live on television, you get 1 minute. And then the light goes on. You get 1 minute to set it. So you make your choices really quickly without really trying to do a lot of processing, assuming that what you're getting is halfway near good or good. A lot of recordings that you get that you only mix, people have put a lot of thought in why it sounds the way it sounds. So instead of, I pull up a drum kit, I listen to it and go, that's not how I would do it. But that's not the point. The point is, what does it do in the song? Why did they think that this should be so bright? There must be a reason. And that's why when I start a mix, I just throw up the faders. I press play and I do a quick balance just of feel, and put the vocal in there. And I very rarely turn the vocal off. And because if you do it so easy, you can make a track sound really great. And then there's no spot for the vocal anymore. And then you have to start carving it out. Whereas if you leave the vocal there and you pull the guitar in and it's too loud or it's in the wrong place, you will hear that immediately because the vocal disappears. Mm-hmm. Or if you're doing an instrumental track, or like if I do David Garrett, classical violin, who does also pop music. I do both his, I do his pop and I do his classical stuff. I put him in all the time, and it's sometimes even challenging and tiring to listen to something that's the most important thing in your mix, because every time you bring something in, the violin disappears or the vocal disappears, you got to figure out what would I just did that just changed my whole mix until you turn it back off. Oh yeah, now I like my mix again. So it's that, and it's balancing. And the only point that I was trying to make during this whole going through the mix and showing the different things is if you check instruments individually, they might sound great, but then you put them in the mix and it makes other stuff disappear. Or like with the Hammond organ, in the end, it didn't need any processing. It just needed the right balance and it would sit. Because when the guy played it, he made the sound fit the track.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, in organic and acoustic mixing and in EDM, it's completely different. There you start with a beat and whatever is important to make the groove, but it's still about the heart of the song is not necessary to get the most pristine sound, is to get the sound that makes the song work, that makes the song groove, makes the song dance, makes it so people cry or makes them laugh or whatever. It's that what you're looking for when you pull up a balance and you listen to it and go, oh well, vocals a little flat, and you add a bit of open the vocal a little bit without doing anything to the rest. And you could have the chance, that you're done with the mix after an hour, because what's recorded works. And even if it's in lo-fi, accept the fact that they recorded it that way, they wanted to hear it that way, and try and work with that instead of changing it.
Right. I've got to say, so much of what you're saying right now reminds me of so much of what I've heard from so many of the best mixers. And I think some of the common threads there, one, that you spend a lot of time in the beginning when you're focusing on level, you're really looking at the big picture. So you're not getting too deep into the weeds and micromanaging the wrong things. And you're getting the big picture right first. And then your insistence on making sure that the most important thing stays the most important thing. And I think those are two things that a lot of beginning and amateur mixers get wrong right off the bat, myself included, when I was learning, is that we just want to dive right into the kick drum and start tweaking the kick drum and solo and then the snare drum and so on. But your approach is almost the opposite of that, where we're looking at the big picture, we're trying to figure out what's the most important thing in the song and how do we keep it the most important thing. And you're really trying to not just impress other engineers with pristine sounds, but make sure that the end listener has the right things emphasized for them. They're feeling the groove of the song, that they're getting the kind of emotional arc of the song. Now, a question for you, when you're taking this approach of starting with really just your levels, and particularly in broadcast where you have so little time to do a live mix, does bus processing become an important part of that? Or are you starting this initial stage with nothing on the master bus? Or are you going into some type of bus processing, particularly in broadcast or maybe even in the studio environment?
Well, it's in both. The bus processing becomes an important part. It's always on.
Yeah.
I have it on from the beginning. So I immediately hear what I do when my balance changes with the bus presser. So you have to have a correct gain stage. Mm-hmm. So it starts like, you can't be pushing all everything up and then you're 10 dB too loud on your output. The compressor is not going to take care of that. That's not the job of the compressor. The compressor is to create a sound and glue it and give it a character or give it some punch or any of those things. So you have to have a good gain structure. That's a very technical thing, is that your complete input to output gain stage needs to match before you start mixing.
This is going to be the last question for me, Ronald, before I get into questions from the audience, but just to get a little more detail on that, can you tell us a little bit about your bus? Are you using a kind of multi-bus setup? Is it really just a single master bus? And are there any particular meters that help you with the gain staging or targets around that end of things?
Yeah, so I use VU meters. I have peak meters to see what happens, but I use VU meters. They tell me energy. Energy is important when you make a mix. Loudness, mm-hmm. control. I use VU meters for that. I use API 2500 bus compressor with in series after the compressor. I use NTP peak limiter. They're all very old broadcast limiters. You have to go on internet to try and buy them. They're not made anymore, but they're high quality and extremely fast, mm-hmm. and can give you up to 3 dB of loudness gain, not level, loudness gain. Mm-hmm. And then I use VU meters to make sure that I stay in my correct gain stage, which means I I hardly go any louder than +3 on a VU meter, because a VU meter zero VU is -14 or -16 in the digital domain, or -80, whatever you choose your converters to be. So that's where your relationship is. And then there's a stupid rule of thumb that comes out of 30 years ago when you did the live broadcast, is a bass snare, a kick snare, bass, and vocal cannot be louder than zero VU. And then you add the rest. And then you get to your +3, +4. Your compressor keeps that nicely tight. Your peak limiter keeps your transients under control. So when you have a loud crash, the peak limiter will grab it because it's set to come in at +4. And then there you have your gain stage. So if you do something wrong, you'll hear it immediately and have to change your balance for that, correct it.
Gotcha. So is that a rule of thumb that you still follow to get you into the right ballpark where you're trying to get kick, snare, and it was a kick, snare, vocal, bass all around zero VU individually? So they're summing together somewhere around.
They're summing together. And, yeah.
Gotcha.
No, not individually. That little package should be around zero for you.
Oh, that package is zero, and then everything else brings it up to around three.
Brings it up. Yeah.
Gotcha. So any one of those would be a little bit.
It's Boy Scout. It's Boy Scout broadcast tricks.
Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, sometimes a little rule of thumb can save a lot of time. So if you don't mind, I'm going to get some questions now from the audience, starting with the ones that came in during the premiere of the masterclass, and then we'll get into any questions that you're typing in right now in the chat box. So keep them coming. First question here, I just had it, was William Hall asked, how much or how often in a mix do you discuss with the artist to incorporate their vision into the mix?
At the very beginning, mm-hmm. I always ask for any type of rough mix that they had when they finished the recording, if I didn't record it myself, and study that. And I don't care how it sounds. I study it how it makes me experience the song. And if it's loud, I don't care if they crushed it. It's not the point. The point is to get to hear what they were thinking when they made that song. I do that, and then in today's world, it usually ends up being a WhatsApp call because not many people are present anymore. But there's a little talk, and I ask about specifics if I had a chance to look at the track before that, then I'll go and work for a couple of hours, 3, 4, 5, 6, however much it takes. And when I have a feeling that I got the song in the ballpark where it needs the attention to detail, that requires artist and producer. And I'll contact them. If they're in the studio, it's great. It's easy because I bring them in and they can listen and we work together. If not, then I stream permanently. If the client's not here, I set up a streaming with audio movers, and I stream them 9624 so they can listen at the best possible quality. And I leave that on while I mix. So I don't know if they are listening or not, whatever they do. I tell them not to respond to anything they hear until I respond to them and say, okay, now it's worth listening. I'm at a point where I'd like you to be involved. Mm. And then, you know, from 10 minutes to 2 hours, it's difficult, but then you start working with them to make that last bit of details that they want. And those are very important because it's their baby. They right. need to live with it forever. They have to perform it. And me too, I mixed it, but it's their baby. It has to be the way they see it. And sometimes they make me do stuff where I think, I'm not so sure. And then they ask me the brilliant question, don't you think it should be different? Mm-hmm. And then I always answer, no, because I would have done it different if I thought so. So yeah. This is what I think. Now, if you want it different, no problem. Here we go.
Yeah.
And the thing is, and that's always, and you have to learn it over the years, when you work with other artists or producers, is they have to sometimes learn and listen to what you've done, which is different than they expected. Yeah. Doesn't mean they don't like it, but they need the time for that. So you need to take them along. And if you have someone say, oh, but that guitar is way too bright, I'd like it dark, then instead of discussing, you make it dark because it changes the balance. And then they'll either respond to that, oh yeah, now it feels good to me. If you hear that answer, you go, okay, great. And you turn it up a little bit and you're there. Mm-hmm. And if they say, no, the way you had it, it grooves better, then you go back. It's really that easy to respond instead of discuss.
Yeah, that was great insights there and very relatable. All right, we have a couple more questions here that have come in. One of them asked during the live premiere about how you approached Freddie Mercury's vocals. You worked with in some Freddie Mercury tracks. Was this while he was still alive, or was it posthumous stuff?
Posthumous stuff.
Gotcha. So was this for Surround or for a live album? What was your Freddie Mercury work there, and how did you approach treating his vocals? Was one of the questions.
Album. There was nothing to treat. Mm. It sounded awesome.
Right. Some people, they just sound
I'm
like
serious.
That. Yeah.
They were recorded analog. They just sounded beautiful, like you know them on the record.
Yeah.
Put just a little bit of API leveling compressor on it, and that was it. Yeah. Just to adapt to the mix. But it didn't need anything. Mm-hmm. And that's from the analog era, because people from that age, decade, they were raised to record as best as possible, so that when you pull up the faders, you basically have the mix done, instead of have to redo everything so make it sound like the mix. So that's why if you do back catalog, which I do also a lot, you go back to old great records and you get the copy of it, you pull up the faders, and it already sounds like the record. Because that's how they record it. And today, if you don't have the exact workstation that the original was done in and all the exact plugins, it doesn't sound like the record. So there's nothing wrong with that, but that's how today works. So but I come from the days where you recorded an album and it was done. The vocal needed a bit of reverb and that was your mix. Mm-hmm. And what it does do is it makes you make decisions. It makes you be aware of where things are going. So you can record a sound, and that sound is related to what you have already recorded. Whereas in today's world, with all the modern music and modern plugins, you can make a sound, and then somebody sings, and somebody else plays the guitar, and then after that, you can change everything again. And then you end up either throwing stuff away, redoing it, or it works. So it's a different process.
Yeah, this has made me think of another question of my own, which I hope our listeners don't mind if I selfishly ask. It'll just take a second, guys, which is when you're doing a live album for, say, a band like Queen, where you've heard the studio version of that song before, do you try to be influenced by the way mix decisions were made on the original studio album, or do you treat the live record like it's its own separate animal? Like, how much are you consulting the original vision of the original studio mix for the kinds of balances that you're going to go for when you're doing a live version of something that had previously been on a studio album?
A lot, if it's possible. If the same ingredients are there, you try and come as close to the heart of the song as possible. Mm-hmm. It's difficult because live sometimes doesn't have the same ingredients as it did originally on the record. But then you're just looking for the same vibe. And of course, with that live stuff, you have an audience, so that helps.
Sure. Another question from a character named Bernardo Reyes. You're not going to be the first person he's asked this of. He's asked in our MixCon chats before. He says, is there going to be a Q&A? I have a very important sandwich-related question for him. He wants to know what your favorite sandwich is, Ronald. Can you tell Bernardo your favorite type of sandwich? You'll have now be one of many MixCon people who have answered this question.
Bacon, lettuce, and tomatoes.
Oh, good answer. BLT, way underrated as a sandwich. And the mayonnaise is such an important ingredient in the BLT.
Absolutely.
It doesn't get a letter. Isn't that weird? Shouldn't it be a BLMT?
It should be, but it doesn't get it. But they put it on and it's just a great sandwich.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, moving on from here. I think we're all going to be hungry in the chat now, so we might have to end this call early now so we can all get a bite. But our next question here, I think this one's a good one to ask now because we only have about 15 minutes left before we have to let you go. So near the end of this mix, you did get into your kind of surround sound approach and philosophy. And Sid Bass asks, How are you routing your stereo mix into surround and Atmos? If you are, did the client ask for a surround mix or an Atmos mix? And how do you prepare for both mixes? So you addressed this a little bit in the Q&A, but can you give us a little more sense about the routing and how it comes up, that whether or not you'll do a surround and what number of projects will have a surround mix on them?
Well, the number of projects is getting more.
Portion of project, I guess.
Yeah. Now, today, if you make a new stereo mix of a new product, then it requires you to also hand in for most labels an Atmos and an Atmos or Sony 360. Mm. The way I do it is that whole process happens on the console. So I have individual mono faders on the console, and each fader I can pan into an 11.1 output bus. And then I have, for each channel, I have 8 object sends in the analog domain. So that goes to a 7-1 bus, 2 stereo buses, and 8 objects. That is done on the console. So I basically mix always in Atmos. And on the channels of the 360 VIX console, at the top of the channel is a stereo bus. So my main bus is an Atmos bus or a multi-channel bus. And it has additionally a stereo bus. So it's not a down mix. It's a real stereo bus. Each channel has not a fader, but a pot where I can change the balance in the stereo mix. Now they're all lined up equally. So they're all unity. And 9 out of 10 times that summing gives me a really good stereo mix. And if not, I can adjust some of the things individually. That goes into a second Pro Tools system, which is my recording system that records the stereo mix separate, and then a 7.1.4 or a 9.1.6 plus 8 objects. If I want to have more objects, I'll do that in the digital domain. But both mixes that I do simultaneously are discrete multi-channel mixes and a discrete stereo mix. It's not a down mix. And that's because I have the fixed console that allows me to do that. Mm-hmm. So I can listen to both. I can, in my monitor section, I can switch in the analog domain. I can switch between my Atmos mix and my stereo mix. I can compare them in real time. Mm-hmm.
All right. Great answer. And next question we have from a couple people, both Tom C. and someone named I, ask the same question, which is about dealing with transients in a digital environment. Now, I know that you're not working exclusively in a digital environment, although you're using a lot of plugins. You're also there on a console and you have your analog mix bus chain. But they're asking about plugins that might help you flatten or soften the transients. Are there any things in particular that you're looking to do to kind of soak up or smooth out transients in digital platforms? Are there any plugin tools that you find useful for that, or are you leaning heavily on hardware for that kind of thing?
No, I use plugins for that, but I'm always trying to get my transients to work for me instead of getting rid of them. So as in the queuing, there are people that like to EQ a lot of plus or a lot of minus because of phase relationships. So if I have too much trenches, I'm going to first look if somewhere else in the spectrum of that instrument, I am missing tonality or frequencies that make these come out really hard. Mm-hmm. If not, then I use SPL Transient Designer, which allows me to soften the transients, the speed of it, and make them longer or shorter. Works really well. Fab filter, brick wall limiter does an excellent job without changing the tone of it. And then PSP has a xenon limiter that does the same thing. It works really well. Mm-hmm. But first, I try to see if the reason I have too many transients are if I miss any other frequencies in the tonality of the sound.
All right.
If not, then I use plugins, not hardware.
Makes sense. All right, I'm going to try to go through a few more. Ronald's already been so generous with his time here. I think we've been on for a good half hour or more already.
We're good.
Yeah, we're getting close to 350. So I want to see if I can ask a few more of the questions that came in during the live presentation, but these have been great answers. Sarah Galvin asks, maybe this is a quick one, but she said, this might be a dumb question, but I'd like to know what volume level you mix at. So here, I think she might be referring to more to how loud do you listen? Do you have a set level you're trying to listen at?
Yeah, 85 SPL.
Oh, wow. That's fairly loud for mixing. I mean, mastering, I'm often listening to those levels, but that sounds like it's so much fun to listen to that level. But can you give us a sense for how you came to that level? And are you listening the entire time at that level, or do you switch levels at all?
I switch levels. I 85 SPL is when I turn it up. I want to know that everything works well and every frequency, and especially the low end. Yes. And then generally, I'm way down, 45 at the most. I have two markers on my volume control, a blue and a red one. And that's where I go to. And every now and then I go maybe in between just to check something. But I'm usually at the lower volume because it balances and it cues better.
Right. But it's essential to do that check at 85 to hear that low end.
It is it's very physical. It's very personal. So at some point I decided, I want to know what that is for me.
Yeah.
And so wherever I was in the studio, I turned it up and I go, this I like. And I would measure it. It would be 83 or 84.
Yes.
And And then I got another place and I do the same thing. And so there, play a track that I know well, turn it up. Oh yeah, now I like it. I go, 85. So it's somewhere around there, but I know other people that for that go to 90, 91 and others don't go over 60.
Yep.
Because it's very, very physical thing and very personal.
Yeah. No, when I was, one of the first things that I learned from my mastering mentor was that he would do exactly that. And he would spend significant amount of time listening a specific dB level. For him, it was 81 dB. And he says, I do not know what the low end on this record sounds like unless I know what it sounds like at 81 dB. And that's how I know what the low end sounds like. Because I feel there's a sense memory in my body that I've developed for this. So I kind of went for the same thing. But me being a little bit younger, I pushed a little bit louder. I think mine was 83 dB. But that was where it really felt right to me and where I knew whether or not it was sitting. So great to hear you say that. But then, if you listen at 85 for like 8 hours straight,
I couldn't do that.
That'd be maybe a pretty bad day. All right. Next question here. Question from someone named Dridian. He says, does anyone know why you have he has a master boost at 370 hertz on the vocal? It seems like that would be a honky zone. Do you recall boosting in the lower mids in this area on the vocal, and why and what do you be looking for in boosts out of that area? Because it's when people first learn about EQ, they learn cut the lower mid range, and here you are boosting some lower mid range. So do you have any thoughts about when and why you do that kind of thing?
I do it to give it a bit more character. Mm-hmm. So on its own, it might sound maybe a little too much. But again, I use the E27 of PSP, and that is such a smooth and gentle EQ as a plugin that 3 dB is really not much.
Right.
It gives it a little bit, but in the track by itself, it would sound a little bit. And the bell that I used is not so, it's pretty wide. It might sound a little bit too much of that frequency, but in the track, it makes the track move more. It makes it dance more. Mm-hmm. And like with this track, I was just looking for, same with the piano when I used the Impressor. It was just to get the groove of how he plays the piano to come forward a little bit, not necessarily to compress it, but that was just using that compression as a different tool. I wanted that groove, that movement in the piano playing to come up.
Yeah, this is something that comes up again and again when I talk to truly great mixers like yourself, is they use this kind of language that you're using of, trying to enhance the groove. Like, what does this EQ boost do to the rhythm of the song? What does me boosting this area on the piano do to like the arrangement and what rhythms are emphasized? I think that's big.
It's the same with the people record a shaker with the best possible condenser microphone that they have, and then afterwards they EQ the shit out of it because of what it does, it kills the track.
Yeah,
you could record it with an SM57 and it would sound just right, or with a ribbon microphone and it would sound even better.
Yes,
because a shaker doesn't have that high frequency it played in a group.
No,
it doesn't.
It gets swallowed up by other things around it. Yeah.
Yeah. So you only hear the movement.
Yes. Yeah. And that's one thing I would love to impress upon new mixers is watch how much high end there is in your high percussion. It doesn't necessarily need 10 and 20K boosts to be heard.
Nope.
So, yeah. Often a lot of the great mixers are doing the exact opposite and letting the mid-range of some of these elements speak better. All right. One question from Henny about immersive. He says, does the immersive session get its inputs from the stereo session? Does Ronald use one machine if it is two sessions? Does that question make sense to you?
Maybe. So I have one session, Pro Tools session, mm-hmm. that I route out to the console. And there I make a immersive panning scheme through mono and multiple channels and buses. Like I said, 11.1 bus structure in analog with pen pots that can do that. And then 8 object sends from, and from the same channels, I derive a stereo mix parallel. It's a completely separate mix, but it gets fed by the same sources that the 11.1 mix is fed from every channel on the console. So basically it's two consoles at the same time, but it's compressed into one channel. So I do both at the same time and I can switch in the monitoring to listen to both at the same time. And what I usually do if I have to do both is I make sure that my immersive panning, my Atmos panning works, that goes to the right buses, that the stuff kind of sits well. And then in the monitoring, I switch to stereo and mix the stereo mix. Because underneath that, I'm only listening to the stereo mix, but underneath that, all the signals also go to the Atmos mix. And when I'm done with the stereo mix, I just press a button on my monitor controller, and then I listen to the Atmos mix and go, well, not too bad. Or, oh, I want to, you know, there I want to change some stuff in the immersive version. But it has no influence on the stereo version there. So I do them at the same time.
All right. Good to know. And we've got some questions now coming in during the live Q&A. Let's see if we can get to a few of these. I know we've both got to jump off pretty shortly. But a bunch of comments came in. Really a lot of warm thanks for this from the people who watched. Just so much positive feedback here. But I'm going to try to keep it focused here on the questions. Dridian says, wow, PSP AudioWare makes some of the best musical sounding plugins I've ever used. I hope to get an E27 EQ today because now I've heard of it from the master. So yes, PSP, big thanks to those guys again. And they are doing a giveaway. Sid Bask asks, please tell me PSP is giving away something. And they are. If you go to the MixCon Mega Giveaway, go into the description of this YouTube video and you will see a link to the MixCon Mega Giveaway. We're giving away more than $10,000 worth of gear. There's multiple chances to win. I think we're going to have 3 total winners. So check that out. Do yourself a favor right now, as I'm saying, go in the description and sign up for that as you are listening. Let me see if I can pick out a couple more questions here. Here's a good one from the Eerie Synthesist, who says, hi, Ronald. Do you use the same ballpark approach as this with groups and mixing on electronic material such as Depeche Mode or maybe, you know, more modern EDM stuff? So the approach that we saw today, does that change much for more electronic rather than live music?
No. No, it's still looking for the hard in electronic music and especially in EDM. It's more about beats and more about bass, and so it does give you other priorities. But the way I approach this is the same thing. I did stuff for Ferry Costa. I did stuff for I forgot all the DJ names now. Armando Jao and Engineer's Ears, which is from England. They're all heavy EDM stuff, but I work in the same way. And it's, most of these guys, when they've worked with me, I did an album with them in immersive, they would go, I'd never look at my own music that way when I mix it. But now I am. Because the thing is, we, and this goes back to when I started 40 years ago, we got trained by people that know how to balance and know how to listen to music. And it's learning by doing. And now they go to school, which is great because there's so much more complex stuff to learn in workstations and plugins and electronic synthesizers and all that stuff, which is great. And then they come and they learn to work with it and they learn to produce it. But in the end, nobody really taught them how to mix. So, You know, take the distance. And now it's not your stuff anymore. It's somebody else's stuff. And now you have to try and feel what was actually meant. Because so many times they produce, and I had it with some students, but I came with a track, and they said, would you mind in the 2 hours that you teach with us to have a whack at this track? Because we can't get it to work, but we love the song. And they produce it themselves. And they had an SSL 4000, so Logic, and we pulled it up. It was not more than 18 tracks. And it was really dark EDM, beautiful. I loved it when I heard it. I balanced it, put a bus compressor on it, put a little bit of reverb on the vocal, put a bit more thump in the kick, and sat there and listened to it. And the guy said, yeah, that's exactly what I meant. How did you do that? And I haven't done anything yet. I really didn't. And they sat there, and the guy was completely... And I said, well, what did you? And then he played me his mix. I was completely broken. But the process is that they've done finishing it. It's the good. And then they go track one, kick, make a new sound. Track two, snare or whatever, and make a new sound. Bass, oh, let's change the bass. So individual going through the stuff, which I've already done when they composed and recorded it. Right. I forgot that actually what they recorded was really well.
Yeah.
And I just turned off all their plugins and just run it.
It's so powerful and so overlooked by especially newer mixers that the balancing part, the mixing part of mixing is the most important part of mixing. And we just get so focused on, oh, there are all these fancy tools. Isn't that what makes you great is using these fancy tools? And it's like, it's kind of plugins. Secondary. Yeah.
Yeah. Then if you turn everything off, actually, what they actually created and did, it was already done. It was great.
Yeah,
I know. I'm not trying to say bad things about schools because they're trying to teach these kids, and I teach too, so many things, and in such a short time. And you know, they're all doing a great job in that, and some focus on other parts more than others. But it's that. Particular knowing what not to do.
Yes.
And it doesn't come from me. It comes from Bob Ludwig.
Yeah.
He told me that once years ago. And he said, Ronald, you can mix. It's just you need to know what not to do. Mm. And that's basically what mixing is. You need to know what not to do.
Ah, that's wonderful. I think that's probably a pretty great place to end it. We do have several more questions that have come in, but I feel like if we start diving into them, we'd kind of end up with going way over. So the last quick thing, maybe I'll ask just to give it a final question. There's one question that a couple people asked, and it's something I don't think was addressed in the presentation, and this will be our last one. But first, okay. PSP Audioware is in there telling us what PSP stands for, and it stands for Professional Sound Projects. I wish it stood for Polish Super Plugins. Unfortunately, it doesn't. Yeah. It is Professional Sound Projects, which makes sense. But we had this will be the last question, although that would have been a lovely one to end on. I promise the last one. But two people asked about saturation. Someone named Panning asked about saturation on the mix bus. He's been getting into saturating the sides more than the center and wanted to know what you think of that approach. And then Sebastian is also in here asking about, I wanted to know about your approach to using saturation on tracks. So if you can give us a sense for, do you use saturation on individual tracks? Do you use it on the mix bus? And do you ever treat sides and mid differently on mix bus processing?
No, I'm old-fashioned in it. I don't treat it differently. I try to do that in the mix part and not in the stereo bus or the multi-channel bus. Yeah,
MS processing is much more mastering applicable than mixing applicable. You have the pan knobs right there. So
my wife's a great mastering engineer, and there I totally get it.
Yeah,
that mastering engineers use a mix site because it gives them tools to do stuff, and it's great. It's a great technology, but I prefer then, you know, if I need to do the sides differently, I prefer to do it in the mix part. Mm-hmm. If you do everything in the box and you have a lot of multiple buses, I can understand why you try to do that because it creates space. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, and saturation does the same. I don't like to use it on my mix bus because I think it kills more than it brings. If I want saturation, I would do it on individual tracks because mm-hmm. then you can control and balance that. Mm-hmm. And then if I can add one thing to that is usually with that comes a lot of widening processing on mix buses. Please stop doing it. It drives you crazy because you create this big hole in the middle and it gets really wide. Yeah. But when it goes down to streaming, nothing's left over of it.
Right. Yeah. The width is a nice thing in a SIP test. You go back and forth and you say, wow, it sounds impressive. It's been pulled out. But what most people are listening to is the heart and soul and center of the record. And there are some people who mix very well with very wide feeling and also a lot of center, but they are doing that more with panning than with stereo processing. Yep. Rather than taking all these sounds, they panned out 20 and 30 and then applying a stereo widener on the mix bus. No, they're panning something straight down the center and panning something's very hard. And especially at the mixing stage, that does seem to make a lot more sense.
And again, that same tool is great in mastering. Yeah. That's why that belongs.
Right. Yeah. Yep. Know what not to do. And also know that there are certain tools that don't make as much sense in mixing as they do in mastering, and mid-side and stereo widening are probably two of those. Well, Ronald, yeah. I'm sure we could ask you questions for another 2 or 3 hours and get another 2 or 3 hours of fascinating answers out of you. But I know that I've already kept you a little bit long past 4 o'clock. But thank you so much for taking the time to do this. Tremendous feedback on this. Just so many nice things that people have said in here. We got through a lot of the questions, all the questions that came in during the live premiere, as promised, and a good number of questions that came in during the Q&A. If people wanted to keep up with you, see what you're up to and all that, what are the best places for people to keep up with what you're doing online?
They can go to the studio website, or they can go to propaprensound.com. That's my website. It's currently under construction. It'll be up in 2 days again. And that's where we post all our projects.
Great.
And what we're doing, where we're visiting, where we're teaching. But that's currently down because we just changed it. We're going to have it up and running again by AES.
All right. Wonderful. So check it out there. We'll try to put a link into the description here for that after this concludes. And big thanks again to the artist, Jeremy Oliver, for letting us check out this track. And especially big thanks to PSP. If you have not been using PSP plugins as of yet, you are missing out. You probably saw that Ronald used them all over this mix. I saw him use the inflator, I feel like, more than anything else. I saw him use the spring reverb and the plate reverb a whole lot on this mix. There's so many that he uses, and you got to try out their tools for yourself. So go over to PSPAudioWare.com. That's PSPAudioWare.com, or just type the letters PSP plugins into your search engine of choice, and you'll find their site. I believe you can probably get free trials on all of them. Magnificent sounding plugins. I've been using their stuff for probably at least 2 decades now, and so has Ronald. And also, I got to say, really attractively priced too. Just the value you get out of their brand is incredible. They make things that are as good or better than brands that cost significantly more with just great user interfaces. So love those guys, love their tools, and really loved having Ronald here. Ronald, thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, you're so welcome. Love being here. Really enjoyed doing it.
Awesome to hear. Thank you guys for hanging out with us. This has been Justin Coletti of Sonic Scoop, this time with Ronald Prent. Remember to check out the MixCon Mega Giveaway in the description, and we've got more MixCon presentations coming up. Check them out at mix-con.com. That's mix-con.com. Be sure to sign up for some more of the live premieres and live Q&As then, so you know exactly when they're happening. Thanks again. I've been Justin Coletti of Sonic Scoop with Ronald Prent. See you next time.
See you next time.
All right. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of the Sonic Scoop podcast. If you want more depth on mixing, check out all the free MixCon videos on our YouTube channel. But you can also check out my full-length course on mixing, Mixing Breakthroughs, over at mixingbreakthroughs.com, where I draw on more than a decade of studying the way that the best mixers on the planet work. All of the amazing MixCon presenters are the kinds of people that I've interviewed, produced masterclasses with, and picked the brains of for years to figure out what are the common threads that really separate great mixers from those of us who are still trying to improve. You will get a full roadmap, a repeatable process, a framework for mixing, with insights on how to do everything from setting balance and pan to EQ, reverb, delay, compression, and a whole lot more. Check it out at mixingbreakthroughs.com with a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you prefer to know everything that I know about mastering, which is what I do day in and day out these days, you're going to love the full-length course, Mastering Demystified. And last but not least, this podcast is always sponsored by Soundtoys, makers of some of my favorite creative mixing effects in the known universe. Try out everything they make for free for 30 days at soundtoys.com. This has been Justin Coletti of Sonic Scoop. Thanks for hanging out with me. See you next time.